Welcome to El Petróleo Es Nuestro, Episode 5, Poor Planning. I'm Brandon Seal. In the last episode, Antonio Bermúdez presided over his self-proclaimed golden age of Pemex from 1946 to 1958. Production and refining levels returned to and surpassed their pre-expropriation levels, and the government's use of Pemex as a tool of economic stabilization and subsidy to Mexican industry seemed to have contributed to an unprecedented decade of economic expansion in Mexico. But this use of Pemex as the primary lever of Mexican economic policy relied on Pemex's ability to generate income and indirectly subsidize the rest of the Mexican economy at the expense of Pemex's own profit margins. In the last episode, we noted that Pemex had lost money in each of the last 4 years of Bermúdez's administration. But if you take out the cost of subsidies and taxes, Pemex had actually been fantastically profitable during all of Bermúdez's years, as it remains to this day when taxes and subsidies are removed from the equation. But taxes and subsidies never could and never can be removed from the equation when talking about Pemex. As Bermúdez so well articulated in the last episode, Pemex existed in order to generate benefits for its various constituents, not to retain earnings. And by the time Bermúdez's successor, Pascual Gutiérrez Roldán, took office in 1958, the need to generate income for the national treasury was paramount. During Gutiérrez Roldán's 6 years, Pemex would drill almost 3,744 wells, more than double the total drilled during Bermúdez's 12-year directorship. Yet in return to the pre-Bermúdez strategy, 85% of Gutiérrez Roldán's wells were development wells, easy targets that added little to Pemex's reserve base. Still, under Gutiérrez, for the first time since the expropriation, Mexico became a net exporter of hydrocarbons as production levels climbed to record levels. There was another factor driving this focus on development drilling at the expense of exploration as well. As anyone who's been in this business long enough knows, banks hate the exploration part of exploration and production. Production is safe, predictable, and stable. Exploration is, well, uncertain and terrifying. And by the 1960s, Pemex now had banks to answer to. In 1962, Pemex closed their first international line of credit, a $50 million facility arranged by Chase Bank. International financing would forever change Pemex's decision-making process. The national interest might be important, but so long as the full faith and credit of the Mexican government was at stake, it was international financiers that would become the most critical stakeholders. And once international finance had been accessed, the ability to lever up Pemex proved to be an irresistible temptation for Mexican politicians. Even though Pemex's cost of capital was slightly higher than the Mexican government's, Mexican politicians quickly discovered that by taking on debt on Pemex's balance sheet, then extracting revenues from Pemex via taxes and subsidies, they could push their annual deficits and a large portion of the national debt onto the national oil company. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. It was Pemex's success prior to 1962 that enabled them to first access international finance. It also allowed Mexico to take an even more aggressive stance against the foreign oil companies. In the previous episode, we talked about the risk-sharing contracts, whereby foreign oil companies had been allowed to participate on a limited basis in certain Mexican oil fields in exchange for bringing capital and new technology. But worldwide, the 1950s and 60s saw a surge in oil nationalism, as nations such as Iran, Iraq, Egypt, Argentina, and Indonesia all nationalized their oil industries, and other countries such as Kuwait, Libya, and Saudi Arabia aggressively renegotiated their original concessions with the foreign oil companies. Mexico's example no doubt helped inspire this oil nationalism, particularly by 1960, when production in Mexico had reached double the level it had been at only 20 years prior when the expropriation took place. So it fits well within the spirit of the times and with Mexico's, quote, leadership in the field of oil nationalism, that it passed laws in 1958 and 1960 which prohibited risk-sharing contracts going forward, reserving to the Mexican state not just the ownership of the subsoil, but its exploitation as well. It was Pemex's generous cash flows and the emergence of a separate oilfield service industry willing to sell technology rather than requiring equity in exchange for it that made the cancellation of these risk contracts a non-event and preserved Mexico's status as the most radical major petroleum jurisdiction in the world. These same laws also reserved, for the first time, all primary petrochemical production to Pemex. The 1941 petroleum law, passed in the aftermath of the expropriation, explicitly allowed for private involvement in the petrochemical sector. Up until the 1960s, Pemex had plenty of other low-hanging fruit to go after on the exploration and refining side, and so hadn't really attempted to develop major petrochemical centers. But with production and refining humming along by 1958, petrochemicals now appeared as a potentially high-margin activity, made all the more so by Pemex's monopoly on the importation of all such products. That said, like the cancellation of the risk contracts, the reservation of primary petrochemical production to Pemex was not a particularly contentious move. For one, petrochemical production is highly capital intensive. Very few groups within Mexico, apart from Pemex, had the balance sheet to support a move into petrochemicals. Second, Mexican industrial concerns had become quite content with the stabilized, subsidized prices at which Pemex sold them industrial feedstocks like fuel oil and natural gas. With Pemex's entry into petrochemical production, they saw again a likely government subsidy to their business and a major competitive advantage for them worldwide. And three, sufficient vagary was built into the petrochemical law such that the definition of a, quote, primary petrochemical would and could be changed over time. Secondary petrochemicals, by contrast, were left entirely open to private investment, but with the protection for Mexican investors that such investment must be 60% or greater Mexican. And so, during much of the late 50s and early 60s, Pemex made major investments in the petrochemical industry. In 1960, Pemex produced only 57,000 tons of petrochemicals, which for these purposes includes sulfur, ammonia, and NGLs like propane, enough to satisfy only about 37% of the national demand. But by 1970, Pemex would produce 396,000 tons of petrochemicals, fulfilling 84% of the national demand and representing 10% of Pemex's revenues. Again, these were high-margin activities, made the more so by Pemex's monopoly on the products within Mexico. So successful was Pemex's entry into petrochemicals that Pemex pushed to expand the list of primary petrochemicals in 1971 amid plans to further expand this line of business. But, as many of you by now probably suspect, there was another major factor at play here as well in the cancellation of the risk contracts and the expansion of Pemex into the petrochemical space: the Oil Workers Union. And, conveniently, taking more and more pieces of the value chain out of private sector hands also eliminated from the market any competitive threat posed by independent contractors to the union's wage and benefit scales. Throughout the 1950s, the oil worker union's power built on itself as its membership grew to over 50,000 members during Gutierrez's directorship. In their 1961 collective bargaining agreement, the union secured from management a commitment from Pemex to require all of their third-party contractors to use only union crews. This, of course, forever prevented Pemex from realizing any cost savings by outsourcing activities to private contractors. Pemex now had, effectively, a legal obligation to overpay for everything. But there was another provision of the 1961 collective bargaining agreement that was even worse. Under that agreement, all contractors performing work for Pemex were required to set aside 2% of revenues under their contracts for, quote, social works, community support projects like building roads, schools, or things like that. Seems innocent enough, right? The catch, however, was that this 2% would be administered by the union. The Oil Workers Union now had a slush fund. To the extent that the Oil Workers Union had always been intricately intertwined with Mexican politics, it should come as no surprise that the union took on all of the characteristics of a Mexican political organization. That is, for most of the 20th century, allegiances in Mexico weren't defined by political party, because there was only one true political party for most of that century. No, instead, allegiances were private, familial, and patronage-based. Think of the old Roman model, if that means anything to you. As under the Roman model, and like in the rest of Mexican politics, the Oil Workers Union functioned along a strict patron-client model. Workers were dependent on their union bosses for their work assignments, their advancement, and access to coveted union benefits. For 70 years, the Oil Workers Union was a critical piece of the PRI party's coalition. And so, for 70 years of collective bargaining agreement negotiations, the Oil Workers Union could count on support from within government and could count on the unwavering loyalty of its members. By design and almost by definition, this strategy consistently painted Pemex management into untenable negotiating positions. In a political context between Pemex, who the state went to great lengths to portray as the responsible, selfless steward of the nation's hydrocarbon bounty, and the Oil Worker Union's 50,000 members plus dependents and admirers throughout the labor movement in Mexico, well, that's an easy decision for a patronage-minded politician to make. Secretary General Joaquin Galicia Hernandez, or La Quina for short, understood Mexican politics. He understood patronage, and he understood how to wield it. Emerging from Tampico as Secretary General in 1961, When Nakina's secretary generalship ended in 1964, he stayed around as Director of Revolutionary and Social Works, from which post it was his privilege to administer the 2% of revenues that Pemex contractors had to fork over as a cost of doing business. And when, in 1973, secret individual balloting for union leadership positions was abolished, Nakina's machine control of the oil workers' union was secured, and he wouldn't let go for 25 years. Part of Nakina's brilliance as a political operator was how he negotiated with Pemex management, and for that matter, with the government at the same time. Between 1939 and 1967, in real purchasing power terms, union member wages did not increase. This allowed Pemex and the government to show that they were negotiating aggressively to control costs. But union members' benefits and total value of their compensation nearly doubled in real terms. Under Nakina's leadership, the Oil Workers Union would begin its inextricable march toward the 200,000-member-strong organization that the STPRM is today. As with management at the great American car companies during the same period, Pemex management largely resigned themselves to the fact that each new collective bargaining agreement renegotiation would bring increased benefits to the union members, a cost the company would simply absorb and hope to outpace by their growth in revenues. But by the time Jesus Reyes Heroles assumed the directorship of Pemex in 1964, his predecessor's focus on production at the expense of exploration had caused production to plateau. Reserves were not being replaced, and domestic consumption was increasing, so that in 1966, Mexico actually ceased exporting crude, triggering an acute nationalist reaction. First, the few remaining grandfathered risk-sharing contracts still in existence were terminated and paid out immediately. With the rescission of these last risk-sharing contracts, the Mexican oil field took on the form that most of us are familiar with today. All Pemex, all the time, but with a growing presence of international oilfield service companies. One quick note here, our old gringo friend Edwin Pauli managed to survive the 1966 reaction, however, and would hang around until 1974, after migrating his risk-sharing contract into a service contract. I'd love to know if that poor SOB actually made money in Mexico in the end. I've known a lot of stubborn gringos that have hung around Mexico losing money for a long time. Second, in 1965, the Instituto Mexicano del Petróleo was formed, a public research organization dedicated to developing technical solutions to industry problems, to conducting basic and applied research, and to providing specialized training to Pemex. In short, the goal was to learn how to explore for oil and gas without having to rely on foreigners. The Instituto Mexicano del Petróleo would grow into a very proud institution, giving a dignity to the science of oil and gas exploration that is typically denied in the U.S. But to be fair, it's hard to point to any particularly innovative technologies spun out of the Institute. In reality, the Institute became more the academic arm of the oil and gas industry in Mexico, focusing its research on the vast proprietary set of geological and geophysical data made available to it, and on studies evaluating the potential effectiveness of foreign technologies on Mexican reservoirs. But the formation of the Institute was an important sign of Pemex's first real push into exploration as technique. Whereas Bermudez had focused on exploration, he had done so as a capital allocation decision, not as a commitment to the art and science of exploration per se. Reyes Heroles didn't just give money to his exploration department, he prioritized it, and, as with the Institute, did all he could to encourage its development. Reyes Heroles dedicated almost 50% of Pemex's budget to exploration activities during his tenure. Geologists and geophysicists were trained in the latest technologies, given the greatest tools, and newly empowered to drive the drilling programs. It's no coincidence that these initiatives would lead to the great world-changing oil finds of the 1970s, credit for which belongs squarely to Pemex, the Institute, and the associated initiatives of the 1960s. I think this new exploration drive marked the beginning of a shift in Pemex's view of itself as well. Until the late 1960s, Pemex had been fundamentally a nationalist, conservationist, even mercantilist entity. The logic ran, our primary objective as an organization is to provide hydrocarbons to our internal markets. As long as we are doing that, we are doing well. After all, oil is a limited resource, and exploiting more than we need today is shortchanging Mexico in the future. But a subsistence strategy simply wasn't going to be sustainable for Pemex, and Reyes Heroles understood this. The pressure on Pemex was already too great. From the government, from the unions, from foreign operators itching to come in and develop Mexico's bounty. If Pemex didn't actively undertake a strategy to grow, it would die slowly, by attrition from these outside pressures. At the beginning of this episode, I mentioned another factor contributing to this fundamental shift in Pemex's mission, namely, seeking and accepting international financing. There's a tragic irony to all this. to free up the capital necessary for Pemex to comply with their goal of contributing to its various nationalist constituencies, Pemex had to access international credit markets, whose cold capitalist covenants would eventually take precedence over the priorities originally articulated in the nationalist vision of Pemex. By taking on more debt, Pemex could free up money for price subsidies, taxes, union benefits, yes, and a little bit more exploration, but mostly price subsidies, taxes, and union benefits. But to be able to borrow, Pemex needed to expand their borrowing base by exploring more and taking on even more debt. It was a vicious cycle, and you can tell where I'm going with this. My thesis here is that the beginning of the end of the nationalist vision of Pemex articulated by Bermudez was the day that Pemex took on international financing, and that it was only Reyes Arroyo's strategic moves to strengthen Pemex's exploration capabilities in the 1960s that forestalled the day of reckoning by a generation or more, and which would temporarily validate the nationalist view of Pemex. Which brings me to the most common line of attack that runs throughout the literature on Pemex. In short, the critique is that Pemex wasn't inherently flawed or systemically doomed, but that its future struggles were the result of poor planning, or of planning under pressure from political expediency. Such critics point to the 1960s and 70s as a period where the nationalist vision of Pemex was given its fullest expression without meddling from politicians and achieved spectacular results. They point to the change that occurred only after the great finds of the 1970s of appointing primarily political directors rather than industry men as a deviation from the nationalist vision rather than perhaps a necessary outgrowth of it. They claim that a political appointee's lack of job security and longevity result in a lack of strategic long-term thinking. Pemex's future struggles, the criticism goes, were a result of poor, overly politicized planning. And because most of Pemex's executives lacked clairvoyance, it's not hard to come up with a list of things they failed to foresee. But as you can tell, I don't buy it. For one, the poor planning argument is too politically convenient. It assigns blame to people for things they never could have or should have foreseen. It's a facile critique that makes the critics seem as though they could have or would have foreseen the unforeseeable by making the critique retroactively. There are probably more Ivy League PhDs in the Mexican executive branch than in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And these guys love to plan. Pemex was famous for its five-year plans. They were detailed, brilliant, and comprehensive, and they were usually entirely out of touch with reality 6 months after they went out the door. Third, what executive in private enterprise doesn't suffer from job insecurity and outside pressures as well? If anything, a political appointee in a single-party, patron-client political system probably has far more job security than any executive in the free market. No, the problem with Pemex wasn't its inability to plan. It was its inability to respond. As I've said in other places, the oil field is magnificent and cruel. Few other industries have to contend so frequently with such dramatic collapses in their revenues over short periods of time for reasons totally beyond their control. But the successful oil companies, like, frankly, successful companies in any industry, are the ones that are able to react quickly to changing market realities. And reacting quickly was never something that Pemex was able to do, in many ways because of its insistence on multi-layered deliberation and planning by some of the most educated people in the Western Hemisphere. But none of this is to take away from the fact that Pemex did plan well throughout the 1950s and 60s, and they also executed well, but they did so during a period of stable oil prices and unprecedented economic expansion in Mexico. The 1970s, in contrast, would disrupt world oil markets like never before, and Pemex would be one of the largest beneficiaries, but for much baser economic reasons than Pemex's nationalist mythology wanted to believe. When market conditions flipped a decade later, Pemex would never quite be able to recover, destined to be forever trying to plan its way back to prosperity. In the next episode, the oil finds of the 1970s will lead the Mexican president to assert that the only remaining task now for Mexico was to, quote, manage abundance. But Pemex's growing wealth would lead to the slow and steady erosion of Pemex's independence, as Pemex's finances and those of the Mexican state became increasingly intertwined, to the ultimate detriment of each. Thank you for listening. Please don't forget to rate us and subscribe on iTunes, and you can download old episodes at www.brandonseal.com. For this episode, I'm going to recommend Joel Álvarez de la Borda's Crónica del Petróleo en México de 1863 a Nuestros Días. This is an officially sanctioned history of oil in Mexico from Pemex, published in 2006, the approximate year of Mexico's peak production, but also published at a time when cracks in the facade were beginning to appear. How a nation mythologizes its history is as critical as actual historical fact in understanding a people, and so I recommend it to anyone wanting to understand how Pemex saw itself. Hasta la próxima.